Campus FM presents A Book, A Thousand Stories. A review of the book, The Hare with Amber Eyes, by Edmond de Waal. Production and presentation, Patricia Salomone. Musical advice by Gerald Fennec, and technical support by Samuel Attard and Carmelo Grech. We have now reached episode 12 of A Book, A Thousand Stories, and we are getting close to the third and last part of Edmond de Waal's book, The Hare with Amber Eyes. The atmosphere is getting heavy. Gone are the golden years of the Hotel Effrussi in Paris's splendid new area on the Monceau Hill, and of the Effrussi Palais on the Ringstrasse in Vienna, created to the glory of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. Emmy, beautiful and young when she went through her arranged marriage to the sullen, much older Victor, is now not terribly well. She looks much older and slightly surprised by middle age. Her great-grandson tells us, and, he continues, she still falls in love. She says she is not quite ready to be a grandmother, but like any grandmother, one who cannot resist telling stories. She sends her grandson Victor, Elizabeth's son, a series of colourful postcards from the stories of Hans Christian Andersen. Elizabeth, Edmund recounts, had moved away from Austria to Switzerland, but her husband, Henk, was not an able businessman. When the finances became intolerable, she took the boys off to Oberbosen, a beautiful village in the Italian Tyrol. Sometimes she took the children back to Vienna to visit their grandparents and their uncle Rudolf, now a teenager. Rudolf is tall and handsome. It is suggested that he had little in common with his much older siblings. He plays the saxophone, his music echoing in the vast, empty home. And what about Victor? Victor, who unexpectedly inherited the onus of running the family financial business, has run it half-heartedly and has seen much of it slip through his fingers during the difficult years of the Great War. What about Victor, who back in 1899 married the love of his life, spoilt, pampered, and never faithful? Victor now hardly pretends to be a banker anymore. Still, The bank is doing well, perhaps as a consequence of the competence of his deputy, Herr Steinhauser. Victor, who has always loved his books, is now immersed in his collection of incunabula. Anna, the faithful Anna, is still here to help her lady, who is now in her late 50s, to help her wear her rope of pearls, looped around her neck and down to her waist. There are 8 servants to keep the stasis perfect. Nothing really happens. But much is happening outside the protective walls of the Palais Effroussi. Elizabeth and her boys are visiting the grandparents in Vienna in July 1934, when the Austrian SS effect a coup and the Austrian Chancellor Dollfuss is assassinated. It is the signal for the Nazi uprising.
Anschluss refers to the annexation of Austria by Germany in March 1938. This German move, effective an invasion, was in violation of the Treaty of Versailles and of that of Saint-Germain of 1919. 19th century argument as to whether there should be a larger or a smaller Germany, that is, including or excluding Austria, had been resolved in favor of Austria remaining separate. On the grounds of language and ethnicity, the Nazis wanted to incorporate Austria as part of Germany, although neither language nor ethnicity by themselves signify one nationhood or statehood. The rise of Nazism actually rather distanced Austria from this new totalitarian expansionist Germany after 1933, although Austria was also an authoritarian state. When the Austrian Chancellor Dollfuss was assassinated by Austrian Nazis on 25th July 1934, an attempted coup failed. One opponent of a takeover of Austria by the Nazis was Mussolini, who feared Germany would be too close to Italy for comfort. He sent troops to the Brenner Pass and supported Austrian independence. At the time of the assassination, the Chancellor's wife was visiting Donna Rachele, Mussolini's wife, in Italy, as they were friends. As time wore on and Hitler consolidated his grip, using more propaganda and violence, Austria's commitment to fight for its independence began to waver. The new Austrian Chancellor, Schuschnigg, proposed a referendum which he was expected to win, but the Germans effectively invaded before it could be held. Historical footage of the German arrival, not least of Hitler himself to his birthplace at Brunau, shows hysterical scenes of greeting and joy. How far that was staged or representative we may never quite know. But evidently there were strong Austrian popular elements who felt close to Germany and Germans, or who were in awe. The message, as bluntly implied by Hitler, was that Germans living across the border should all be part of the Reich. Schuschnigg resigned and the pro-Nazi Chancellor was appointed. France and Britain limited themselves to lip service, not wishing to risk a war, another war. And even Italy now came round to accepting Germany's annexation of Austria, hence the Rome-Berlin Axis. This reluctance to engage Germany emboldened Hitler, as may be seen from his subsequent annexation of the Sudetenland in Czechoslovakia. In the wake of the Anschluss, Himmler and other SS officers went to Vienna, arresting supporters of the First Republic. A savage clampdown began on Austrian Jews.
sister, the paterfamilias, is anxious. It is not in his nature to take action. He reads several papers, perhaps searching for some form of reassurance. He can find none. The Austrian National Socialists have been receiving funding from Hitler's Germany. The Führer demands that members of the Austrian Nazi Party be released from prison to participate in government. The new Austrian Chancellor agrees. On 13th March, a plebiscite on Austria's independence from the Nazi Reich will be held. History is not now helping Victor. Reached part three of the book, which will take us through the fateful years between 1938 and 1947. History knocks hard on the door. History slams through the door of time and breaks into the heart of humanity to produce a worse catastrophe. And it is all beginning here, in the heart of Vienna. And the Palais Effrussi, remember, is bang in the middle of Vienna's Ringstrasse. The coming pages are hurtful to read. I read them with a sense of shame. Shame for belonging to the human race, which is capable of acting as beasts would never dare to. Flowing and musical the previous chapters of The Hare and Amber Eyes have been, that I am tempted to skip this chapter 24. Here, the author, in but a few words, exposes the Nazi violence that goes through the elegant streets of Vienna like a hurricane. It is a hurricane that sweeps away centuries of propriety, of carefully constructed politics, of a traditional, static way of life. In March 1938, a plebiscite is called. Is Austria to remain independent, or is it to tie its destiny to Germany? Hopes are high for an independent Austria, and the Israelite community puts up the huge sum of 500,000 shillings to help towards the campaign. The plebiscite was a bastion for the Jews, but the German Reich presented an ultimatum to the small Austrian nation. Chancellor Schuschnigg was to resign in favor of the pro-Hitler Arthur von Seyss-Inquart. Meantime, German troops marched on the border. Bloodshed, the Austrian Chancellor broadcast his resignation on the radio. In this hour, I take my leave of the Austrian people with a German word and a heartfelt wish, God protect Austria. And then, the Wahl tells us, the music plays Gott erhalt Franz der Kaiser, the former Austrian national anthem.
Franz den Kaiser, unseren guten Kaiser Franz, hoch als Herrscher, hoch als Weiser, steht in des Ruhmes Glanz. Liebe windet, Lorbeer reise, ihm zu ewig grünem Kranz.
Victor, now 68 years old, Emmy and the young Rudolf listen shocked, while Anna places the tray with their tea and Emmy's heart pills on the library table. Immediately there is shouting down in the Schottengasse, Ein Volk, Ein Reich, Ein Führer, death to the Jews. It is a flood of brown shirts. There are taxi horns blaring, and there are men with weapons on the street, and somehow the police have swastika armbands. There are trucks rushing along the ring, past the house, past the university, towards the town hall. And the trucks have swastikas on them, and the trams have swastikas on them, and there are young men and boys hanging off them, shouting and waving. By 11:15, Nazi flags are hanging from the parapets of government ministries. At 12:30, President Miklas gives in and approves the cabinet. Austria is now National Socialist. Schuschnigg is in solitary confinement. Friends of the Öfrusi packed a suitcase, and by 9 p.m. the 11:15 train to Prague was completely packed. There are queues of people on foot or in cars at the Czech frontier. Once more, Victor could not take a decision. I cannot but transcribe the author's words. No other words could better express the sudden invasion of the family's privacy, their surprise and terror. the sounds of the street became shouting in the Efrusi courtyard, echoing around the walls and off the roof. There are fists on the door. There are 8 or 10 of them, some with swastika armbands. Victor, Emmy and Rudolph are pushed into the library. Someone bangs out a tune on the piano keys. They come into the library and tip the globes from their stands. They take the silver candlesticks. They tear Emmy's pearls off her neck and they take her rings. The desk Emmy used as a dressing table, the precious Louis XVI wedding present from Fanny and Jules in Paris, is sent crashing down the glass roof. It takes a long time to fall with a sound of splintering wood and gilt, glass and marquetry. It clashes onto the stone flags on the courtyard. The broken drawers scatter letters across the courtyard, while all across Vienna, doors are broken down as children hide behind their parents, under beds, in cupboards, anywhere to get away from the horror, from fathers and brothers being taken away, from mothers and sisters being abused. De Waal considers. They have walked past this house for years, seen the courtyard as the doorman holds the gate open while the fiacre trots in, and later as the chauffeur drove the car in. They are inside now at last. The house has been breached. De Waal writes, as my grandmother and grandfather sit in silence in the library, there is Anna picking photographs of cousins from the floor, sweeping the broken fragments of porcelain and marquetry, trying to close the door that has been opened. In the meantime, is happening outside, in Vienna streets, on the Ringstrasse, outside St. Stephen's Cathedral. It is Sunday, 13th March 1938. Hitler has taken over Austria. Dr. Seyss Inquart is now the new Austrian Nazi Chancellor. Snow is on its way.
Hitler always saw violence as a means to an end, and he wrote a supposed autobiography in the mid-1920s, Mein Kampf, mainly in Landsberg prison, after his earlier attempted putsch in Munich, November 1923. Realizing his oratorical powers, playing on popular emotions, including antisemitism, he noted that it was by the power of speech that the masses of the people could be moved. The failure of the Munich putsch also convinced him to attain power with the existing machinery, rather than against it. In other words, to use democratic institutions in order to undermine and abolish them. He never accepted the republic set up at Weimar, or indeed the social democrats associated with it. When years later Germany would be losing the Second World War, one largely instigated by his expansionist diktat and racism, rather than cut his losses as President Ebert had tried to do in 1918, he would insist on total war and a fight to the finish. Hitler's rise to power is immersed in intrigue, inter-party deals, duplicity, sustained all the time by recourse to demagogy, social engineering and intimidation, even within his own ranks, subject only to unconditional loyalty to himself. The pure and superior Aryan race would prevail over all comers. The NSDAP's electoral showing in 1930 and even in 1932 led well-placed interlocutors to convince President Hindenburg, a respected but elderly war veteran, to appoint Hitler as chancellor, almost as a safety valve. Although Hindenburg mistrusted him and disapproved of his methods, he was led to believe that Hitler and the Nazis could be controlled. In his book Hitler and the Collapse of Weimar Germany, Martin Brotzat quotes one aide reassuringly telling Hindenburg in 1933 that one would know how to deal with these young chaps, who are basically quite nice. Soon afterwards, the enabling law was passed, whereby the Führer could effectively do what he liked and as he pleased. So he did, including pouring ruin on the whole of Europe and an unprecedented organized mass extermination.
In the grey dawn, when there should have been a plebiscite for a free German, independent, social, Christian and united Austria, there are neighbors on their hands and knees, kids and elderly, scrubbing away at the Schnustig plebiscite slogans, making Vienna clean again. The old man who owned the newspaper kiosk on the Ring, the Orthodox, the Liberal, the Pious, the Radical, the old men who knew their Goethe and believed in Bildung, the violin teacher and her mother, all surrounded by SS, by Gestapo, by policemen, and the people they have lived next to for years, jeered at, spat at, beaten, bruised. On Monday, 14th March, 1938, Hitler, the Führer of the United German People, entered the capital of the Ostmark. Be with me next week for another episode of A Book, A Thousand Stories. I wish to thank Professor Henry Frendo for his erudite interventions, a history lesson of quality.